You know our slogan around here is better practice, better life. But we're taking this belief to the next level. And we've recently announced the creation of a new association. It's called the Best Practices Association. Our association celebrates the mindset that is better practice, better life. This mindset celebrates time, healthy living, personal growth, clinical excellence, and impacting the lives of your patients and your team through intentional leadership. In fact, we are the work-life balance experts in dentistry. The BPA will coach independent dental practices like yours to thrive by sharing best practices and operational habits, behaviors, systems, tools, and insight that lead to profitability and sustained growth, and you can still have a life. So if you're a dentist that wants to surround yourself with great thinkers, let us help you create your own version of better practice, better life. Go to actdental.com/BPA or hit the link in the show notes.
Hi, I'm Dr. Paul Henney from the Bob Barkley Study Club, and you're watching the Best Practices Show with Kirk Barrett. Hey guys, thanks for watching the Best Practices Show. We take a look at the best business practices from the best dental practices all over the world. And we're so grateful you're watching. Today we're going to be talking about an incredible legacy in dentistry and how it applies more than ever, the Dr. Bob Barkley legacy, with the man behind carrying that legacy forward, a good friend of mine, Dr. Paul Henney. And you do not want to miss this. Don't miss this. So grab a pen and hit the share button and sit right in. Now, a couple things. We are shooting this live on Facebook. So as you're watching this, please add questions to the feed because we want you to get the most out of this in while you're here. And then also, too, we're watching the metrics. A lot of you guys are watching these later on, you know, a couple days later. Continue to add questions to the feed, and we'll do our best to respond them. And again, because we want you to get the very, very most of those. Please keep sending us suggestions for shows. Got a bunch of them yesterday, which I love, love, love. And we'll do our best to line all of these up. We are now up over 38,000 followers on Facebook, well over 150,000 hits on iTunes. I don't even know how that happened, but thank you, thank you, thank you. And we're so pumped. Now, my guest today, good friend of mine, Paul, I've known you for a very long time. And actually, when I was just broke trying to get this going, I would sneak into your seminars and you were gracious enough to let me in for free. And I think you would even buy lunch at times for me because I was just trying to get things going. And before we get started and we jump into this, because we're going to cover a lot today and the behavioral side of dentistry and what we're going to be talking about. For people that don't know who you are, tell us who Dr. Paul Henney is, where you came from, where you practice now, and who's Dr. Paul Henney?
I'd be happy to do that. Just it's great to see you again, Kirk. We did go back for a long time, and I do remember when you were just getting started, and I'm so proud, really, of what you've been able to achieve.
Thanks, man.
You've narrowed it down and really, I think, gotten focused in a really excellent direction. So. That's fantastic. About me, I graduated from the University of Michigan in 1984. Right after graduation, I took two part-time teaching positions at the University of Kentucky, and I moved down to Lexington, Kentucky and practiced there. And I tried to establish my own private practice at the same time. So I was kind of doing three things at the same time, actually four. I opened up a kitchen shop at the same time, and so I was doing, it was like a four ring circus I was doing at the same time. And I was struggling to get patients for my practice at the same time I was teaching. And within about 2 years of me starting that practice, I became friends with a dentist in town who had gone to the Pankey Institute and had also employed Avram King in his practice. And Avram King was an avid follower of the work of Bob Barkley. So that's how I got exposed to it, really within like 2 years of my graduation. And when I became exposed to this information, it completely changed my paradigm about dentistry. Coming out of dental school, we tend to sort of have a distorted perception of how it's going to go. Because everything in dental school is very controlled and managed. And I was fortunate enough to have a lot of patients that I worked with in dental school that really were kind and cooperative. And I came out of school with a pretty positive point of view about how it was going to go. But once you get into practice, you realize that people behave very differently than a dental school environment.
Yeah.
In fact, my first job in dentistry was an associateship in a practice that was very insurance-centered. And I can remember just clearly in my head going into the laboratory, the typical laboratory that had the model trimmer and everything in there. And I looked up on the wall and there were, you know, three shelves, blue case pans. And I would just go up there and I would look at them and they would be like crowns and bridge work that was like 2 or 3 years old that had never been delivered. And I would say, Ron, why isn't this case delivered? And you'd say, well, Paul, they never came back because they didn't want to pay their copayment. And that was sort of the initial slap in the face that this was a very different world that I was entering into, the world of private practice. So when I was exposed to the work of Bob Barclay and Avram King and other people, I finally became more aware that this behavioral dynamic was the key piece. If you really want to work with people on a deeper level, on a more significant level, on a health-centered level, there are a lot of things that you're going to have to learn that you did not pick up in dental school, that's just maybe not even natural to you. And so that has really been a major pursuit of mine for years now. This is my coming up in about 2 more weeks would be my 34th anniversary of graduating from dental school at the University of Michigan. So this has been an avid pursuit of mine for at least 32 years. And I've been working on both researching it as well as learning ways to apply it and also teach it through the Bob Barclay Study Club Facebook page and the Bob Barclay Study Club that I started with Charlie Verapapa and Johnson Haygood back in 1996.
Yeah.
So we've been working with this material for a very long time.
Yeah. Now your practice, you tell us just a little bit about your practice because you've been doing this for a while. Where do you practice? What style of practice? Give us some background.
I practice in Roanoke, Virginia, which I would describe as a kind of a typical middle American town, kind of a post-industrial town that's trying to still kind of reimagine itself, try to figure out itself, its new economy. The major employers in town are like the school system and the hospital system, and we have a medical school here now and so forth. So, but we really, you know, a very diversified economy. This is not a boom town. This is more of a backwater place. And one of the reasons that Bob Barclay's work appeals to me is because it works well in an environment like this. This is not, if you look at average income in this town, median income, we're roughly $5,000 or $6,000 below the national average. Doesn't mean we're poor, but it doesn't mean we're super prosperous either. We're probably, you know, it's somewhere around 56,000. If you're just drive north here about 3 hours to Northern Virginia, it'd probably be close to $90,000. So, you know, there are very many, and Kirk, I'm sure you're totally aware of this. There are many different versions of America out there.
Right.
And every dentist practices in a very different environment that require different thinking and strategies. But this particular philosophy, I think, is particularly effective in an environment like this because it's focused on developing patients over time. It's not about the immediate yes, the big case yes today. I dazzle them with all my technology and my knowledge. It's about establishing a health-oriented relationship that's designed to go years and years, and perhaps those choices will play out over time. But ultimately, all the decisions are taken in a direction that are in the patient's benefit long term.
Yeah. So now let's break this up because back in, you know, when I was 25, a great mentor of mine, we talked about Dr. Michael Schuster, actually, when I had a chance, he was so gracious in being able to point me in the right direction. He gave me a little book and it was Bob Barclay's book. I want you to talk about that in a second. I also got the tapes. So I have the old audio tapes. And they're not easy to listen to, but I remember now he died. Bob Barclay died in 1977. Is that true?
That's
now, I was
correct.
I was seven at that time, right. So I didn't know him. But when Dr. Schuster gave me these, I listened to him. I'm like, this guy was way ahead of his time, like way ahead of his time. Can you share with the viewers, because we have some dental students that are watching this now, who Dr. Bob Barkley was and why was his philosophy so important?
Okay, I'd be happy to do that. Bob Barkley was a dentist who grew up in a small, very small town, 600 population, called Ipava, Illinois, kind of south central Illinois. He went to Northwestern Dental School, graduated, I think, in 1954, did 2 years in the Air Force in the Philippines, and then came back and settled in a town called Macomb, Illinois, which is also kind of south central Illinois, farm country. There's a university there, but it's still a small town, 20,000, 25,000 people. Bob moved back there, and he's like kind of like a typical dental student coming out of school, enthusiastic. They think that you know everything. You're ready to conquer the world, and he hit the wall where nobody was really interested in what he had to say or what he could do for them. And so he went on a very long, circuitous route where he studied with Dr. Pankey, roughly around 1960, mm-hmm. and tried to apply a lot of things that he learned from Dr. Pankey. But one of the things that he learned was the things that were working in the booming metropolis of Miami didn't apply well in Macomb. Mm-hmm. There was a significant, going back to the conversation about demographics and income, the things that were working well for Dr. Pankey in Miami didn't work well in Macomb, because the average person in Macomb didn't have nearly the kind of money as the average person did in Miami. So Bob quickly realized that he had to develop some, if he really wanted to have a self-centered practice, he had to develop some other strategies that were going to be more effective. And he met a guy named Nate Cohen Jr., who had a PhD in educational psychology as well as a degree in divinity and others. He met him early, we think probably about 1961, mm-hmm. and he started working with Bob in the application of the work of a guy named Carl Rogers. A lot of people may be familiar with the work of psychologist Carl Rogers. He's one of the most famous humanistic psychologists out there, which is really kind of person-centered psychology, and the central sort of belief is that everybody wants to grow, is capable of growing. It's really the responsibility of the facilitator to establish a relationship that enhances that growth. So Nate Cohen taught Bob about that, and they started to integrate a lot of these things in Bob's practice early on, starting in really the early 1960s. Mm-hmm. And over time, Bob refined that. About 1968, Bob divided his new patient exam into a three-phase examination that he called co-discovery. Co-discovery is a word that a lot of people have probably heard, but they don't necessarily understand how he did it. And it was all structured really on the fusion of three things. It was a fusion of humanistic psychology that Nate Cohen taught him from Carl Rogers. It was infused also with social psychology that they were learning at the time. And it was also infused with the latest understanding in educational psychology. So he kind of took those three things, mm-hmm. and he figured out how to create a new patient experience, if you will, that enhanced learning to the highest level so that over time people would make better decisions for themselves. The initial objective wasn't to get them to say yes quickly. The initial objective was to establish a helping relationship that facilitated better decisions over time. So that's how he did it. And because Macomb was a town where people didn't have a lot of money, he would develop plans with people that they would execute over a period of years. And he said most people sometimes would take 2 or 3 years to execute the plan, but everybody would stay on that track. And one of the more famous sayings that Bob had was, let's keep quality the constant and time the variable. So mm-hmm. he would always develop a proper treatment plan with people and then work with people over time so that they never had to compromise and they always ended up with the outcome that they had jointly developed together.
Yeah, I love this. Now, you use the word, we've talked behavioral. Can you, because it's one of my favorite things, when we talk about the behavioral side of dentistry, Paul, can you define that? Because you live and breathe and teach this all the time. What does that mean?
The behavioral side of dentistry is the human side of dentistry. I think we all came out of dental school, and perhaps still do, with a mindset that if we just examine people and use our logic and our knowledge to overwhelm them with our brilliantness, that they're going to say yes, that they're going to agree to what we do. But it turns out the human nature doesn't support that at all, even though that's been taught for years and years and years. In fact, there were books written about it, that's what you do. You want to divide, you know, want to separate the person's emotion from this decision, and you want to really approach this thing from a logical point of view because everybody functions on a rational level. That's been proven wrong more recently, particularly in the last 20 years, 15 years. You know, there's this new emergent concept that you're probably aware of, Kurt, called behavioral economics. Well, this has changed the world. This has changed the way we think now. And the way we think now is because of neuroscience, we understand how the brain works on a much deeper level. Mm-hmm. Now, Bob worked this out just on an intuitive level, but now we can go back and we can see that everything that Bob was doing is completely in support of what the neuroscience says how the brain works. Mm-hmm. And in essence, we have three different brains. We have a reptilian brain, a brain that's screaming at us, am I safe or not? Should I freeze? Should I run? What should I do? And you have to appeal to that brain first, and Bob figured out a way to do that. Mm-hmm. We have a logical brain, or left brain, that basically stores information. It's basically there for the purpose of executing learned information. And then we have a third brain, our creative mind, our right brain, that approaches things that we don't know everything about. And it uses our left brain as a resource. What should I do with this? Can I learn from this? Should I stay away with it? What should I do? So if we understand how the brain works, we can structure building relationships with patients in a way that supports the way they're going to be most comfortable and make decisions. And that's what Bob kind of figured out how to do. He figured out how to talk to each area of the brain at the right time, so that over time they would be in the right area of their brain to make a decision, which is kind of the negotiation, the left side of the brain. So he would start kind of with the reptilian brain. He would work intentionally through a concept that he called reflective thinking. Mm-hmm. He would go to their right brain. He would reference their left brain and kind of remap it, was what he was doing. He was getting them to rethink about their past and put new meaning to it. And then he would ultimately end up on the left brain side. Once they'd agreed together on what to do, then they would go through a negotiation process, which is a very logical thing. But you need to delay that to the very end of the relationship. Mm-hmm. So, but Bob had figured all that out without neuroscience to support it. Now today we can go back and go, well, this is exactly the way the brain works, and this is the optimal way to take somebody through a learning process, an exposure from taking a stranger essentially to a place. From a place where they're unaware to a place that they're aware, and do that in a way that's not threatening to them, that's not going to shut them down, not stop them from learning, and then infuse what they're learning with their values. How important is this of interest to me? Use that to modify their belief system. Use that to develop commitments. Use that to ultimately execute a plan. You know, collaborate on a plan and then follow through with it. So there are a number of steps. There are about nine. This is kind of, I'll use my crude graphics here. There are about nine steps.
Yeah.
And we think in dental school, if we just come in down here and we overpower and we just show them what's wrong, we think if we take them up to the awareness level, they're going to say yes. But we have skipped all of these other really emotional levels and development of relationship. That we're typically not, you know, we weren't taught about that in dental school. We're not aware of it. But these are all natural steps. And Bob said that the problem with dentists is we stop the process at the awareness level. We assume that at that point logic is going to win the day, and logic rarely wins the day at just the awareness level. That's where the whole facilitation process comes in, with the team and reinforcing new beliefs and new commitments and their will to act.
Yeah. And I'm going to screw this up, so you're going to have to correct me. Now, Bob's book, can you even get that anymore? Is it available?
You cannot get it.
You can't get it. Do you have a copy?
It's backwards, of course.
You have like a real copy. I've got one of those old.
Yeah, this is the original one from 1972. It was printed in Macomb.
So where do you get it? Like you can't get it.
You cannot get it. It's out of publication right now, and there's some copyright issues within the family. They're still trying to work through that. But that's one of the reasons I put up, created the Bob Barkley Study Club page where I could share some of this information without getting into all of those issues.
Okay, so I still have my original copies. I don't know if they're copyright infringement. I mean, they're not even real copies. It's just like all. Now, I'm going to screw this up, but there were so many things I learned when Dr. Schuster gave me that information or exposed me to that information. But one of them was, correct me if I'm wrong, it was a fundamental underlying belief that the more patients were involved in perio, the more they wanted restorative. So correct me on that, but there was a whole level of thinking around, starting slow and it's so funny now because as I look at metrics, I watch the amount of perio that's done and it has a direct relationship to restorative. Now, you might say watching this is pretty simple, but there's a whole level of thinking behind this. Correct me on that.
Well, it's huge. I mean, one of the first things that Bob went out and taught was, what we call today is prevention. Mm-hmm. And he, because of his relationship with Nate Cohen, they had developed a way for people to learn about their status as well as learn more effectively how to take care of themselves. So he created this program of really self-care where people could self-observe their progress, their healing over a 5-day period of time. And people would realize that actually they're the ones that's in control of their health. He would kind of empower them with experiential knowledge. Mm-hmm. And he would engage them in a totally new belief. Now, we have to understand that this is 1965, 1967, 1968. Most people, had their heads full of ideas like, well, most people in my family lose their teeth by the time they're 50. Mm-hmm. Or every time I have a baby, I lose a tooth. Or there were all kinds of kind of wives' tale in their mind. That was their belief system, really, that got infused with them through the culture. So he had to go in and kind of unwind that and get people to think differently about not only their situation, but maybe some of their beliefs are wrong. And in fact, they are more in control than they ever realized. And so the process of taking people through a successful periodontal program really was a learning experience that in fact their oral health is really in their own hands. It's a choice. It's a value choice that they can make or not. Right. And so people that then are successful through a perio program are much more prone to choose restorative dentistry. And Bob would talk about that. He said, do prevention programs damage your productivity? And he said, no, it makes it go way up.
Right.
Because people are engaged and they own their problems at that point. And then they're starting to ask you for finer and finer solutions because they value their dental health at a much higher level.
Yeah. Now you've been able to watch all this for all these years. You've been heavily involved in CE and where it's headed. And I want to, you and I were talking before, the future of dentistry and health centered practices can't be done in a reductionistic way. Describe that, like walk us through that and why, because it applies to what he taught to where this is headed. So put those together.
Okay. Everything that we're talking about here today is associated with Bob Barkley's philosophy. Let's kind of go there for a minute.
Okay.
Barkley's philosophy was a very personally developed philosophy. He certainly learned a lot of things from Dr. Pankey, but he modified it. As I talked, some of the things that worked for Dr. Pankey in Miami and Coral Gables didn't work so well for him in his area. So Bob picked up all these things and developed his own practice philosophy. Out of that came the co-discovery process. And all of these are based on what I would call a holistic philosophy towards people, that it's not just about teeth. It's not even and so it's the teeth and the person and how that person thinks and what that person believes and what that person is willing to commit themselves to. But even that is overly simplistic. It's about their family that they're in. It's about what they eat at home. It's how well they sleep. It's about the culture that surrounds them. So Bob had this very global version of holistic care. This is the late 60s. Just imagine this. Mm-hmm. He was so far ahead. So that's the new thing that's kind of regained a lot of momentum here over the last few years is a more holistic point of view of working with people. At the other end of the spectrum, fighting against it is what I would call a reductionistic or deconstructive way of dealing with dentistry, which is, you know, really driven by the way insurance plans are structured. Everything's got a code. We start thinking of people as just potential code opportunities, coding opportunities.
Yeah.
And all these systems and structures get built around that. And we lose sight that all these codes are associated with people with feelings, and these feelings have meanings and beliefs, and they influence their commitments and so forth. So dentistry is rapidly moving in what I would call an industrialized direction. You know, bigger and bigger corporations and investors are buying practices and they want profits. Mm-hmm. It's about code generation, code filing. It's not going to stop. It's going to move more and more towards economy, scale, efficiency. So that's a philosophy right there.
Right.
That's a business philosophy. That's a philosophy towards people. People are just an opportunity for us to generate money. So on the other end of the spectrum, then we have the counterpart of that, the holistic point of view.
Which I think is a tremendous opportunity.
It's a huge opportunity.
Because people are looking, you know, how do I differentiate? Like,
yes,
we're in a world of starving for significant relationships, and dentists are perfectly positioned. Paul, talk about, like, you look at all the trends that are happening now. Everyone's talking about airway. You got people talking about, you know, arterial health now. And like, I think dentists, there's never been a more exciting time to be a dentist, but in this, you got to find your opportunity. And what you're talking about is the relationship side, which will always drive.
Yes. You
know, I always say this, trust will, no matter what's going on in dentistry, trust drives a dental practice.
There's no question about that.
So talk about that, like how that works in your office and what, because I do have some, let's speak to the 32-year-old dentist that's watching this going, hey, Paul, I understand this, but where do I start? I mean, I got little kids. I got a lot of debt. I get these questions all the time. So I'm just going to give them to you. I have 5,000 patients and it's all PPO. Like, where would I even start? Because it sounds like you have a great practice. What would you say to them? You know?
Well, I think the best place to start is with one person. It's right. One person that you think you're likely to be able to connect with. And I mean, that's the way I did it. You know, you start with the first one and you learn from what works and what does not. There are a lot of things that I could share with you that makes that easier. They're really based on a lot of things that I learned from Bob Barkley. There are ways to develop relationships that are much more effective than the traditional way that you were taught in dental school. Let me give you an example. Mm-hmm. Yesterday, I had a patient come in. We're in the second stage of the three-phase process with this patient, the three-phase co-discovery process. The first phase is kind of like an orthodontic practice where you're just building a relationship and you're taking records. How you do that varies from one office to the next, but there is no clinical examination. I know that's a paradigm buster.
That is, it is.
Everybody's sitting back going, what, you don't do exams on the first visit?
Yeah.
And there's some very solid behavioral reasons why you shouldn't do that. Now, I'm not saying this is for every patient. I'm talking about a potentially comprehensive care patient who's engaged and wants to learn, okay? Right. So I just want to qualify that. So that's what I did with this particular patient yesterday. She came back for the second appointment, which is the true co-discovery part of it, where we're going through clinical findings together. We're learning together. We're looking at photographs. We're looking at study models. We're looking at radiographs. We're looking at what's going on in her mouth. And we're beginning to discuss what her future needs are based on what she's learning and how she's kind of sifting that through her value system.
Mm-hmm.
In this particular case, this gal is about my age. She's in the past, she'd had orthodontic surgery, and I don't think they set the occlusion up right at that time. This was 30 years ago. And since that time, she's destroyed her occlusion. She's lost vertical dimension. Her anterior teeth are very damaged and broken down. And she's literally a 28 unit full mouth reconstruction.
Mm-hmm.
How do you broach that with somebody, you know, a stranger, you know? And so after revealing together that information, she looks at me and she said, you know, this is really a bad situation, isn't it? Do you think I'm going to keep my teeth? long term. I said, I'm not really sure that you will at the rate that you're going. If you do, they're going to be pretty disfigured in 10 years or so. And so that's something that you're going to have to think about. And then she said, well, how much do you think something like this is going to cost? So notice I'm not quoting any fees. I haven't even created a treatment plan yet.
Right.
We're just having a discussion about what if. Oh, my gosh, this is important to me. Right. And I said, well, it's probably going to be about $1,500 a tooth. I still hadn't quoted a tooth. I just said, it's probably going to be about $1,500 a tooth. She did the math in her head. And she said, literally, she said yes to a treatment plan I had not yet presented yet yesterday. She said, well, my mother has set aside some money for me, and I think I can use this for that. Mm-hmm. And I said, okay. I said, there's something that I need to know today. Do you want me to develop a diagnostic wax up so I can get into more of the details of how we would do this case? The fee for that would be $500. She said yes. So she's actually said yes to my full mouth reconstruction treatment plan, and I've never presented the fee. Do you understand? Right. This is how this process goes. But you kind of have to develop the relationship and then cite right sequence so that there is trust. You mentioned how critical that is. And they have to be fully convinced that you're looking out for their best interest long term. I'm not selling her a thing other than the vision for what the future is going to look like with or without treatment.
Right.
That's it. That's what I'm selling.
Right. And I might be oversimplifying this, but Paul, is this probably the difference between them developing their own treatment plan or you just coming up with the treatment? Those are two different mindsets, because when it's my treatment plan, it's my dentistry. But when you start
I think it's really critical that they participate in the design of the plan. Now, you're going to guide them, obviously.
Right.
You're going to use what I call strategic empathy. You're going to
tell me what that is. Like, I love that.
Strategic empathy, you know, everybody's familiar with what empathy is. And that is, you know, to have a good sense of what they are feeling.
Okay.
But you're infusing that with your philosophy and your agenda. So you're guiding them. It's a leadership. It's kind of a leadership infused empathy. So you're trying to guide them towards better decisions. So if they're
with questions, right?
Yeah, absolutely. Open-ended questions. You can use a technique that Bob used. It's called labeling, and where you just label the emotion that they're experiencing. You say, you seem like you're pretty frustrated right now, or this seems to be upsetting to you. Can you tell me more about that? And what you're really doing, and we know now from the neuroscience, what we're doing is we're causing them to go into their left brain, pull something up, reanalyze it. And we know from neuroscience that memories are changed every time we retrieve them. And they're put in a different place in the brain, and they're influenced by the emotion that they're feeling at that moment. So literally, this is what Bob Barkley was doing, was remapping people's brains by causing them to go back and think about their past and what it means and what they want and what the future is like. And we can do that too. They're guided conversations to help people put a more realistic frame about what's happened and what they want and how much they value their teeth and what are they willing to commit themselves to going forward. And you can build these into the conversations with people. And it's amazing what people will do. Like yesterday was a perfect example of it. People will literally treatment plan themselves, not in every exact detail, but they will, in a broad sense, they will almost set the fee what you would set. It's happened to me a number of times where people have projected a fee within just a few thousand dollars of what I would have quoted. And this this happens before I ever put anything on paper.
Right.
It's amazing what people are capable of doing. I mean, we've all seen that with three-year-olds. We're fascinated by what they can do. We grossly underestimate what our patients are capable of doing.
Right. And I heard you say this years ago when I took like one of your courses. One of the things you have to do is you got to be, I'm going to paraphrase, you have to be patient enough to put your needs at bay.
Yes.
Right. Like, how did you say that? You said something like that. One of the key pieces in learning how to do this is you got to take your needs and put them aside. So finish that.
And, you know, the phrase that I heard when I went through the Pankey Institute, you got to hold out for what's in the best interest of the patient.
That's
so, you know, that really, in the mind of Dr. Pankey, that was the kind of the consummate definition of a professional, where their needs are central, your needs are secondary.
And then I would imagine as a dentist, this is just, it gives you probably a lot of joy to be on this journey with patients instead of
saying, I mean, it's the most gratifying thing. I mean,
because you see the lights go on when you're going through this.
And all the way through, whether it's the point where you've made the big transition from where they are to some really nice provisionals, the joy and the continued trust that's built. And then when you're finishing the case, just the ecstatic enthusiasm that they bring into all of our lives. I mean, this is just a really loving, supportive kind of way to practice. And there isn't a more meaningful way to practice than this. And I think, like we were saying earlier, this is where an opportunity lies in dentistry, even though it's going to, you know, this corporatization of dentistry is going to continue. There's going to be this niche opportunity for people that know how to engage people and truly help them with things that they value. And you may have to help them discover what they value, hence co-discovery. It may not be totally apparent to them in the beginning, but if you know how to develop and manage a relationship, these things are kind of revealed. And most people want to feel good about themselves. Most people want to have an attractive smile. Most people want other people to think that they're attractive. All these things are just deeply emotional feelings that most of us have. And it's a matter of just kind of engaging people and just naturally revealing that to themselves, you know. That's kind of the process.
Absolutely. And this is something that you're very passionate about, and I am too, and I think it is the opportunity. And let's combine that with one of the heated subjects that you're also passionate about. I mean, everyone complains about insurance everywhere they go, you know, changing the rules. Now in certain states, you have companies like Delta Premier making all these things go away, and everybody gets so upset. But really, the truth of practicing outside the scope of insurance is you got to get good at the things in which people have to reach into their own pocket, make value decisions about their own health. And there's no shortcut to this, because you see this too. Dentists come out of dental school and they go, I'm going fee for service. I'm like, nobody, you got to earn your stripes first. Like, you have to become the kind of dentist that would deserve that type of practice. And there's no shortcuts to this, right, Paul?
No, they're not. I mean, it's a trial and error thing. It certainly is going to go a lot faster if you're working with a mentor or somebody that's done this before, that's transitioned their practice before.
Right.
You know, every practice that's even deeply involved with insurance still has patients who don't have insurance. And even when people do have insurance, the coverage is so limited that it isn't even going to begin to address most people's needs if you're really going to approach it from a health-centered perspective.
Right.
So you've got to find a way to get around that. You've got to get away. You've got to get away from their natural bias towards loss aversion, which is money in the beginning. So if you don't, and this is what was brilliant about Barclay's work, he kept them out of their left brain. The discussion about loss aversion is a left brain negotiation conversation. If that's where your relationship is going to begin, you don't have much hope in it going anywhere else than being centered around money and insurance.
Wow. This is heavy for some dentists watching. They're like, now I got to help people get out of their left brain. But really, if you get this, it's where a lot of the magic happens in this whole process. Now, I got to ask you the obvious question that I always get. Okay, let's say I'm a dentist watching. How do I get everybody else around me involved? Because you can't do this by yourself, Paul.
No.
Like, you got to have a hygienist that understands this. You got to have an assistant. You got to have it. So where would I start with that?
Well, I think you've got, you know, everybody starts in a different place there as well. You know, when I moved to Roanoke, I bought a practice that had staff essentially that I had not selected. I had to play the game with the team that I had. That was it. And over time, I had the opportunity to replace them in one way or the other.
Or they replace themselves.
Yeah, that's right. Right. So, but you know, eventually you've got to create a kind of a, what I would call behaviorally astute teams, people that are very sensitive, empathetic, who understand the philosophy and are willing to support it and advance it. So this is a team. This is a team game that's philosophically, you know, philosophically driven.
Yeah. So, and you mentioned this. Barclay even did that with his own team. Like,
he did.
You're talking back in the 60s. He would do, was it behavioral testing on his team, or he would be looking for profiles for people that would
match.
How did it work?
Nate Cohen Jr. was doing psychological profiling of all the staff Bob hired starting in 1962. and he was working with him in team development. In fact, Nate Cohen wrote a book on it right here. And it was.
Can I get that one?
It's hard to find. It's not published anymore. It's called Selection, Hiring, and Training of Dental Auxiliaries. It was published in 1970, which is like a super sophisticated book that integrated all these things that we were talking about. Nate Cohen died the year this book was published. And so we have these tremendous thinkers, and all this stuff's just sort of lost momentum as they died. Other people kind of picked up the ball and ran with it, like Avram King and others. But a lot of the stuff lost momentum. It's exciting to me to see some of this stuff reemerging. I know a lot of people like Lynn Carlisle and the Rocky Mountain Rendezvous Group and everybody has tried to keep this thing alive. And I think there's an opportunity now to advance it more. Mm-hmm.
And I want to talk about that opportunity because you've done an amazing job carrying the torch and keeping this thought process alive. Now you not only speak to study clubs, so if you haven't had a chance to hear Paul speak, you have to, because I still have the manuals you gave me like 15 years ago. And I'm not kidding. I looked through them. They're good, good stuff. Now, you also have your own study club. Can you talk about that? What is the Bob Barkley Study Club?
Yeah. And I went to the Pankey Institute starting in, I think, 1995. When I went there, I met this guy named Charlie Verapapa. If you don't know Charlie Verapapa, you will either will soon or you've heard of him. He practices in Old Town Alexandria. I also met a guy named Johnson Haygood, who teaches at the Pankey Institute right now. We met at the Pankey Institute, and this was at that time, I was still really on fire about what I was learning from Bob Barkley. And I said, why don't we form a study club that's really focused on this stuff? We're learning all this other clinical stuff from the Pankey Institute and from Dr. Dawson and ultimately Dr. Spear and other places. Why don't we form a group that's focused on the behavioral and how that integrates into the clinical? So we started that organization in 1996. We brought in all kinds of speakers, Avram King. We brought in Frank Spear, we brought in Bob Winter, we brought in Sandy Roth and Mary Osborne and all these people, you know, in the early 2000s, late 90s, we were kind of working on this. And this organization is still around. I'm going to probably be doing a co-discovery workshop this fall in DC. So if you want to get in touch with me, I can get you on the short list. It'll probably be just a small group kind of learning event. So there's that. There's a Bob Barkley Study Club Facebook page where I'll write things on these sorts of topics pretty much every day, Monday through Friday, sometimes not Mondays. I posted a couple things today. Mm-hmm. You can also go to a website that I have. It's called codiscovery.com, which has most of those writings as well as a lot of historical writings of mine and other people like Bill Lockhart, who I think is just an amazing man. Mm-hmm. A number of people have contributed a lot of things to me to post there that are in the behavioral realm, whether it's hiring, team development, whatever. There are 250 articles or something there, maybe more than that, dating back 10 years. So if this is sort of the thing that interests you, you can kind of go there and kind of pique your interest a little bit more.
Yeah, and I highly encourage you to check this out. So if you're watching this on Facebook, we're posting the links in the body of the post. But if you're listening on iTunes, Paul, it's www.codiscovery.com. Check it out there, right?
Right.
And then you actually don't mind if people email you, right? Questions? No. So paul@paulhennydds.com. Check it out. You can also see his practice there if you want to learn a little bit more about Paul. Paul, I'm just crazy grateful for our relationship. I've watched you grow. You were a hugely valuable piece to me, helping me understand this bridge and put it together. And I remember all those seminars. I'm just grateful that you were, you let me in and let me come in and soak up the information. So,
I'm glad it worked.
So check it out. Excited. Yeah, and I want to have you back, and we'll talk about other components. I'd love to talk about what happens in hygiene, you know, because that's a whole, that's something that has to be developed, and it's a commitment to mastery on that side of things that's outside of restorative. I'd love to have that conversation, and I know that some of you are watching today. We've had quite a few people chime in. All of our friends said, hey, look, good stuff. So we'll have you back for more stuff on this. So stick around while we say goodbye to everybody else. But if you're watching today and you enjoyed today, which I know you did, do us a favor, just hit the share button and share this information with your friends. Keep sending us suggestions that you want to see from Paul and maybe some other guests that are back on the show later on. But until we see you next time, keep watching the Best Practices Show. You guys enjoy the rest of your day.